You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
This episode of On Brand is brought to you by 2020. You know that stock photography look you hate? Like how all the models have those creepy, dead-behind-the-eyes smiles? 2020 lets you buy millions of intimate, authentic, real-world photos. They look like they came from someone's social media account you're jealous of, and they're proven to increase your brand's image. You get 5 photos with 2020's 1-week free trial at 2020.com/onbrand. That's the word 20, then the number 2 and the number 0.com/onbrand to get your first 5 photos free.
Welcome to On Brand, a podcast for brand builders by brand builders. Here's your host, Nick Westergaard of Brand Driven Digital.
Hey, brand builders, have we got a show for you? This week's guest is Laura Reiss. Laura is an internationally recognized branding expert, best-selling author, and television personality. After graduating from Northwestern University in the top 2% of her class, she worked at TBWA Advertising before partnering with her father and positioning pioneer Al Reiss. Al and Laura founded Reiss & Reiss Consulting in New York in 1994. In 1997, Reiss & Reiss relocated to Atlanta, Georgia. Together, the dynamic duo consults with companies around the globe, including Disney, Ford, Frito-Lay, Papa John's Pizza, Samsung, and Unilever, on branding and marketing strategy. Laura has co-authored 5 books with Al, including The 22 Immutable Laws of Branding, The Fall of Advertising and the Rise of PR, The Origin of Brands, and War in the Boardroom. Laura's first solo book, Visual Hammer, has been translated into the Chinese, Russian, Turkish, Polish, and German languages. Words alone can't build a brand. Driving an idea into the mind is best done with the emotional power of a visual. Her latest book, Battle Cry, complements Visual Hammer by outlining 5 strategies for improving the effectiveness of a company's slogan or tagline. In addition to her consulting assignments and corporate speeches, Laura is a frequent guest on major television programs from The Today Show to Squawk Box. She appears regularly on Fox News, Fox Business, CNBC, CNN, and HLN. Laura, welcome to On Brand.
Well, thank you so much. That was quite the introduction.
Well, it is a fitting introduction for a person who, me, in the brand building business, is sitting here looking at my bookshelf and seeing several of those books just mentioned right here. So,
well, I'm glad to hear it.
And as someone with a branding book of my own coming out in a couple of months, I know that the 22 Immutable Laws is really the gold standard in brand books out there.
Well, great. Yeah, no, I think it's been a very helpful book for a very long time. I always love to hear people come up and say it was helpful for them in building their company or business, and it's great.
So, what's interesting about it, I think, I mean, it's hard fixing words in print these days because it seems like the tendency with media and technology is that we end up missing something. But what would you say you've noticed through the years in the book that is as powerful as it's ever been?
Well, I mean, there's 2 parts, I think, in terms of, you know, marketing strategy, and in terms of putting it together in the book. There's the idea, and there's the philosophy, and you know, we've had, you know, some big ones like positioning and focus and some of the ideas, but there's that, and then there's putting it into a book so that someone can understand it, they can use it, they can remember it, and so that's where, you know, when Al, of course, did the Immutable Laws with marketing and then with branding. And so it was a very helpful way for people to understand and to get all of, there's so many ideas that you have to remember when building a brand, from, you know, expansion to contraction to focus to category, all these things. And so kind of putting them all in this book and in easy to read chapters so that you can really, you know, hammer in your own mind those principles and keep them in mind when building your business. The difficulty is, and what I find so fascinating is, you know, there's 22 laws, but you can't apply them all at the same time. That would be a mess. The challenge is, and you know, this is where we meet with clients, and of course they've read the books, but you know, it's hard to implement them. It's hard to know which is the most important law in your individual situation. So that's always, and that's the fun of marketing and branding. It's not easy. There is both an art and a science. There's no formula you can plug in. You have to, you know, you have to know the principles, but there is an art about applying them that makes it so interesting and so challenging and then so exciting when you get it right.
Well, I love all of those points, especially. I'm sure there are people that think, you know, with a book titled 22 Immutable Laws of Branding, that see that as a checklist and let's go do all of those. And when you were saying that about doing them all at once, it kind of gives me the visual of like a dimmer switch that you can move different levels at different times. But, you know, it's pretty bright and overpowering if you move them all up at once.
Absolutely. It is a challenge, and to know, you know, what it's really interesting, because this is a point that so many people miss, I think, today in business. It is very different what a company, and we always make the analogy that a company is like an airplane. And, you know, if you know anything about, you know, aerodynamics, getting an airplane off the runway is incredibly challenging, right? You use 110% of power to get it off the runway. And then at 30,000 feet, you know, you're sitting pretty. You can sit back, have a coffee. And even if you make a minor error, it's easily correctable. You've got lots of time. However, a minor error right there on the runway and you're dead right before you leave. So it's very much like that in branding. And what a startup can do, the startups on the runway, they really have to have everything right, from the name and the category and the focus and the everything has to be just right, and the PR and the spokesperson. But a company at 30,000 feet can do, you know, ridiculous things. You know, Google has made some, you know, exceptional mistakes and investments and other things, but it's okay. They're Google. you know, they have something so powerful that they own search, and they own that so dominantly that, you know, some of the other things they can get away with. But so a small company can't, you know, they can't be in too many businesses. They, you know, if they have the wrong name, it's going to be make it that much harder. If they're, you know, not positioned well in the category, it's going to be that much harder. So, you know, it's always a difference of who you are, as well as who your competition is. You know, who are you competing against? Apple? Well, you know, good luck.
Right. Well, and I think that that's why some of those ideas are so timeless, because so many of the things that you mentioned about your competition, your category, everything else, are all very much alive and well, as much as everything's changed. Some of those dynamics of communicating your brand are as relevant as ever, if not more relevant than ever, because of all of the noise, the distraction.
That's very true, because, you know, it, and, you know, I've now been around long enough that you've heard this several cycles, is everything has changed.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it happens all the time to every generation, and every new generation thinks it's totally different for them, but it's not. Yes and no. So what is the same is, you know, positioning the idea, is, you know, owning an idea in the mind of the consumer. And that is, you know, was true in the 70s, it was true in the 80s, 90s. It's true today. The strategy, you know, of narrowing the focus, of owning an idea, you know, pioneering in a category, using a visual, all these things. I mean, that's the strategy. That has not changed, you know, very little over the decades. What's changed dramatically, of course, are the tactics, you know, how you do that. You know, today you're using, you know, it used to be, you know, just 30-second TV ads. Now we have social media. We've got all sorts of things. So the tactics of how you accomplish this, how, you know, you're doing doing some of the communication and some of the PR and everything else, even the business itself with selling over the internet. You know, all those things have changed. Distribution has changed dramatically, right? But the strategy of owning and building a brand has really not. So it's the difference between, you know, the strategy might be different and the strategy is the same, but the tactics are different.
Well, and I like what you said, too, about the strategy of owning and building a brand hasn't changed. And I do feel like these cycles that you talk about with things, everything's different. And I think that it seems like somewhere along the way, I feel like it's better now, but it seems like there was a few years ago where people really kind of thought that that brand building stuff doesn't matter. And I think that that's falling by the wayside. But really, when you're left with nothing else, that's your organization's biggest asset.
Of course. I mean, it's by and far the, you know, of course, you know, technology, innovation, your product, your service is important. But, you know, if people don't know about it, if it's not perceived, if it's always, you know, it's the perception versus reality. You know, the reality is you might make a better widget, but unless people perceive it as such and remember its name and know where to buy it and buy it, you're not going to be successful. So it's a combination of both of those things. You know, you need both. You can't have a crappy product and just brand it well, right? But having both together, there's a lot of great companies and products out there. But why do some rise above the others? You know, for the most part, you know, it has a lot to do with marketing. I mean, I think you can even see that in Apple and what Steve Jobs was able to do. It wasn't just the technology, although that was incredibly important. But he also combined that with really brilliant marketing techniques. You know, from the name, from the simplicity of the launch. You know, launching one thing at a time, dominating one category with, you know, each individual brand separate and distinct. You know, it was the Macintosh, it was the iPod, it was the iPhone that, you know, other companies don't do. Samsung puts its name on everything from, you know, from dishwashers to washing machines to cell phones. You know, it's a strategy that really, you know, works very, very well and isn't recognized as such as much as it should.
So in talking about the various pieces of your brand DNA, your latest solo works, Visual Hammer and Battle Cry, really break down kind of some of the basic things that are big parts of your brand that I don't know that we analyze as much as we should. So first, talk a bit about the power of visuals.
Yeah, well, it's really an exciting you know, concept to bring, and I think very helpful for companies. So you know, initially, you know, positioning was the big idea that my dad, you know, brought, and you know, positioning was all about owning a word in the mind, and it was very verbally oriented. You know, it was all about words and, you know, positioning of how those words in the mind and everything else. So you know, as such, you know, we focused on words, but you know what. You know, in addition to working with clients, we also study a lot of companies and research and do everything else. And, you know, what we saw is that the companies and brands that were really succeeding also seemed to usually have some kind of visual,
right.
You know, a unique visual identity, not that just was recognizable. But in the most successful cases was also communicating something and driving an idea that supported the position in the mind. And it was much more effective when you combine the words and the visual to drive the idea. So the example of Coca-Cola, they brought back the imagery of the contour bottle a few years ago, and it was incredibly effective. You know, we always talked about, you know, the power of Coca-Cola being, you know, the original, the real thing. That's been, you know, the one thing that sticks in the mind. Of course, they created the category. They've been around for 120 years and more. So, you know, all of those work together, but, you know, communicating it visually seemed to have even a bigger impact. And why is that? Well, you know, we always say, you know, trying to get a word in the mind, you have one mind, but two brains. You have a left brain and a right brain, and they, you know, they operate separately. they have one little connection, but, you know, the left side is the analytical side. It processes, you know, words, sounds. The right side is the emotional side. It's the side of, you know, big picture thinking, just, you know, your creativity and such. So, you know, when you combine, you know, something that is visually and emotionally connects as well as, you know, is driving in a verbal rational idea, it seems to work incredibly well. And of course, visuals, you know, being emotional have become much more memorable, and you can use them more effectively to hammer in. You know, we talk about when building a brand, you want to launch a brand with PR and word of mouth and everything, but it needs to be maintained eventually with advertising because you run out of PR potential. And it's much more, it's easier to bombard people with imagery than words. So, you know, seeing that Coca-Cola bottle everywhere, Corona has done very well with the lime on top of the bottle, right? You've got that, you know, what does that communicate? It communicates the authenticity of being a Mexican beer, right? The leading imported beer now, you know, 17 years in a row in America, or, you know, Colonel and KFC. You know, the guy's been dead a long time, but he lives on as the visual hammer for that brand. And the other thing that this, you know, also dovetails with very nicely, and you know, as we've seen the globalization of brands, you know, words become challenging, right? Because there's language issues. You know, English is the second language for many people, but, you know, how does KFC go into China, for example, where not everyone speaks English, that's for sure. But you can use a visual that doesn't need any translation. And KFC is now the largest fast food chain in China.
Well, and there's something interesting with, of all of the brands that you mentioned, KFC does stick out because they've kind of reinvigorated that visual hammer of the Colonel. Like you said, he's been dead and was then played by an actor after that. But now they've brought him back. And then I think he was a cartoon for a few years.
Yeah.
But now they have these, what I think is so interesting, it actually reminds me of the way, you know, in the old school brand police world, you know, you'd never mess with the logo or the icons. But this flexibility, like with Google and their doodles, I also think is kind of parallel to what KFC does with the Colonel, because basically anybody with the white wig and the white beard and the glasses is the Colonel. I believe, as we're recording this, Reba McEntire is currently the Colonel. So anything is possible.
Gender equality at its finest, I guess.
But I think, you know, making that flexible, I think, is an interesting choice when we talk about hammering at home. I think historically, I think there's still some consistency to that, but some of that flexibility of what that can be, I think, feels new, a little different, but also like it reinforces things in a different way, too.
Yeah, I think, you know, you have to be a little bit careful with some of that. But I think you have to, as Google does, it doesn't change. It doesn't do the doodle every day. They have the consistency of that, you know, like super clean white page, which is basically unheard of in the internet. and then, you know, every once in a while, they do the doodle with an interesting history, you know, information or celebration. And so I think with KFC, if they change the imagery in the stores, you know, they've got the super consistency of his visualization, you know, in the stores, on the buckets of chicken, on everything else. And then combining it with some change in terms of the personalities who are representing them. You just don't want to, you know, make it too much of a joke. It's got to still be about the chicken, right? I mean, I think sometimes they get away with how funny they can be with Reba McEntire, but, you know, how does she relate to chicken? I mean, let's not go too far. But, you know, at the same time, one of the biggest problems I think with them is, you know, they try initially, I mean, of course, they changed it to the initials, which I think long term is can be challenging because they were trying to get away with from fried. But the problem is you can never get away from fried if you're a Kentucky Fried Chicken. That is who you are. And that's why most people go there. Then they have really not been as successful selling grilled chicken and other things on the menu. So, you know, those types of things are issues as well as to, you know, how far you can go from your base, how far should you go from your base, and how much that will help you and how much it might hurt you in the very long run.
That's so true. And the acronym thing, I think, serves as a good segue from visuals to words also.
Yeah.
And in thinking about that, your work in Battle Cry, And why do we, first of all, speaking of words, to get a little meta, why do we have so many words for the words that go with our brands? We've got slogans, taglines, brand promises, mission statements.
Some of that I think is the fault probably of my own consultants and ad agencies to, you know, have things and make themselves, you know, here's what our work is and everything. Scope of work is creating this and that and the other thing. And I think a lot of it, it means nothing because the idea is, what can you get the consumer to remember? And I doubt they can give you many of those things off the sheets, in terms of the promise and the this and the that. So, and that's where I think battle cry is something that sums it up in a way that, you know, is meaningful to consumers, as well as company, employees. I think it's a really important, especially today, that, you know, our employees are our greatest ambassadors. And for them to, love the brand, promote the brand, speak about the brand. And the idea of a battle cry is something that is memorable. It is powerful. It has, it's something that, will give you drive, and not just a silly, tagline or slogan, which, for the most part, if you look at most companies, they're really throwaway lines. They don't mean anything. What's Ford's latest tagline? It's go further. Really? Yeah. I mean, do they give you extra gasoline? I don't get it. It's not something, it's not a rallying cry. It doesn't get you up and excited, the way the ultimate driving machine for BMW does for its owners and its engineers and everything else. But putting it together, and I think, the words are important. And I'll just say one thing about, when you have acronyms, which, usually are nicknames. It's not bad to have a nickname for a brand, but it's usually a mistake to change the name of the company to that nickname.
Right.
Because it takes away the nickname. and you always have to remember that a new generation is going to need the words so they know what the brand is about. My biggest gripe is you see now bottles of Gatorade that just say G. Well, first of all, no kid is ever called a G.
Yeah.
And they're going to eventually forget the heritage of Gatorade. It was the Florida Gators, and it's what, propelled them to win in the second half of games. And there's a beautiful story there, an authenticity that they lose when they just call it G. So, for Battle Cry, how can we create, knowing what your, word you want to own, what your category is, what your visual is. And then, of course, word of mouth is so important that that's where the battle cry is. You can't show someone a picture. I mean, you could, but, it's people talk to each other. They tweet with each other. They text with each other. What are the words you can put in their mouths to make it easier for them to talk about your brand? And so if you have, Little Caesars, it's the commercial is as annoying as heck, but it's pizza, 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 pizza. It was two pizzas for the price of one. So you take the idea and then you think of an interesting way of communicating it. And, there's so many great, if you have a small child, there's easy ways to get them to remember something from nursery rhymes, right? Using alliteration. People are much more to remember, alliterative names like Dunkin' Donuts or alliterative slogans. Repetition, like I just said, repetition. Reversal. Broiling, not frying was a great one for Burger King back in the day. I mean, that really set them up and what was the difference? It was broiling, not frying. I think people forget that for the most part. And then, of course, a double entendre is always a fun one. And women, we're just off Valentine's Day here. So, the double entendre of a diamond is forever. I mean, what woman doesn't love that slogan, right? Anything to get more diamonds, right?
Well, it's so interesting, the formulas there and the thought that goes into some of even something as simple as pizza pizza. Yeah. But I also think there's something to what you said about if you want it to be things that your community, that your people can say, it needs to be things that they would say. For me, right. a huge red flag on the Gatorade point was when you said, and I never thought about it, was nobody says G. That's not a thing it's called. I have kids that play basketball and drink Gatorade, and they're not talking about G.
No, they don't. It's a for some reason, and some of this goes through phases of, you know, there was, yeah, let's shorten it as short as possible to, you know, just the letter. Well, you know, that takes away. I mean, there's some times it's better to be longer. You know, one of the most famous slogans ever was FedEx. You know, if it absolutely positively has to be there overnight, there's sometimes poetry in having, you know, at least in one part of your brand, the explanation, you know, and whether it's in the name itself, whether it's in the slogan or the tagline or the battle cry. But that story is incredibly important. You can tell it with visually. But having that there, when you take away and try to shorten it, you're missing an opportunity, particularly in packaging. You've got a great opportunity in packaging of telling your story. And quite often, you know, companies forget, you know, they don't put the battle cry on the slogan, on the package when they certainly should.
That is so true. I love the opportunity of packaging. It kind of brings us full circle back to Coke, who I also feel like is trying something different with their cans now. They have a kind of a narrow, tall, skinny can. So seems like they're trying to do what they've successfully done on the bottle side with having a unique package for their product in can form.
Well, they've got a unique package, but they're putting it on a very traditional brand that is losing customers.
Yeah.
You know, Diet Coke is something that people really don't want, as a matter of fact. It's got the words for two reasons. It's called Diet, which is a no-no these days. And it's got the artificial sweeteners, which people are trying to avoid. So, it was the one brand that had the most problems. And, you know, it's funny. Sometimes, you know, companies, they spend, or even parents, you spend all the time on the on the problem kid when maybe should, you know, support the one that's doing well. That's the bad parenting advice, obviously. But, but, you know, you in a company, I mean, for parents, you can't actually do that. But in a company, you can. you know, and some of our advice for Coca-Cola has really, you know, when it comes to violating the law of expansion, I mean, they have just, you know, done so much damage to themselves. I mean, the Coca-Cola Life product, for example. I mean, what is that?
Yeah.
That's not something that people are ever going to order. You want a life? I thought I was okay, but thanks. All right. they have a challenge, right? As people, you know, have come to view soda as the enemy in terms of having, you know, too much sugar, too many empty calories. They, of course, had the diet products that, you know, for many decades. But, you know, diet has become, you know, an evil word in terms of people don't want, it's perception, right? If something is called diet, there's no way it's going to taste good in the mind. I don't care what's in the product, in the mind it's going to taste bad, you know, compared to the original. So the diet products had a problem. So then they came out with the zero products, right? Coca-Cola Zero, which, you know, has done quite well for them. And now they call it zero sugar, which makes it a mouthful. But there's an issue here of having so much choice that it undermines the power of the simplicity of the brand. You know, and our suggestion was, you know, why don't you just get rid of the sugar Coke and just sell one Coke and have it with natural sweeteners so that you can, you know, take advantage of that, as well as, you know, the complexity of the Coca-Cola product is something that, you know, is quite universal in terms of people's liking of it. You know, it doesn't have a single note. It's got a multiple note, like a wine. And so you can drink a lot more of it than you can orange soda, for example, which gets old really fast.
That's a really good point with their troubled expansions and perhaps potential contractions there as well. It makes me think a bit of, you mentioned Dunkin' Donuts, and I know they seem like they're putting out test balloons to kind of float out this idea of dropping the donuts. And it is, because I understand where the thinking comes from, but it really seems like these inflection points that Coke with their expansion and Dunkin' Donuts still with their naming wanting to, I guess, expand but kind of contract their brand name a little bit. Those are really critical times.
Well, it is critical. And I think, you know, it also has very much a long-term significance, is that if you shorten it right now to Dunkin' and take the donuts off, most people like me have grown up with it their whole lives. I see Dunkin', I think donuts, right? and not that I would go in and eat a donut, although lots of people do. I just like to have a coffee there. But, you know, having the donut in the name isn't such a negative. I don't, you know, they take it too literally, and consumers don't, you know, sit in a boardroom all day and think literally about the places and the brands that they go. And over time, you know, that name was very important, I think, in establishing, and donuts were very important in establishing it. I think they will play a role in that brand, although, as we see, you know, coffee in those experiences become more important. But having a name that is specific doesn't necessarily hurt them. And I think they're making a huge mistake. As you know, KFC, they were so afraid of fried, you know, trying to take it out of their name, when it gave them something very specific and tangible and a history that belonged uniquely to them. And here, Dunkin' Donuts, again, I mean, that is something so, you know, so special. And Dunkin', I mean, when you take away the donuts, the word is ridiculous.
Right.
You know, is it basketball? What are we talking about? I think it becomes, you know, you have to think of people, you know, they've got to have an easy way to file it in their mind. And when you have a name like Dunkin' Donuts, which, again, has that alliteration, it's specific, because donuts, it's visually, you can file something that has a specific as opposed to an abstract. When it has that visual along with it, it's much easier to remember. And you take away a lot of that, you know, specialness and uniqueness about it when you do silly things like that.
Amen. Well, hopefully there's someone from Dunkin' Still Donuts listening. Laura, as we start to wrap up, what is a brand that has made you smile recently?
In a good way or a bad way? Because I smile in all sorts of ways.
You know, I didn't say this time, but I do when someone is having trouble coming up with one. I say it can be both kinds of smiles.
I love I love Tommy John. You know, Tommy John. Well, I love it. I get a little frustrated with it. So Tommy John underwear. No adjustment needed. I've never worn. I'm not a man. I don't have those stuff. But I've got two boys, almost going to be teenagers. I've got a husband, and I've seen them, you know, adjusting.
Right.
But and I love Howard Stern, and their big break was giving the underwear to Howard Stern. He talked about it, you know, a very viral and word of mouth campaign of these, you know, underwear selling, you know, obviously they started direct and now they're in Nordstrom's. But I love the simplicity of that brand, of, you know, reengineering something as, you know, simple as underwear, and, you know, and charging a premium for it that people are willing to pay. I mean, you wear these things all the time. you know, making an investment, you know, is a good thing for a lot of people. So that brand, of course, now, you know, I get crazy with them because I think they're expanding too much, too fast into too many types of products in terms of now they're outfitting the man from, you know, socks to t-shirts to, you know, who knows, maybe it's suits soon. But there's a tremendous value in starting with one garment. And so many big brands have done that, from Tommy John, you know, with underwear, Vineyard Vines with ties. They also always make me smile. And even Under Armour with their shirts. But, you know, expanding too fast, you've got to be, it's a tricky balance of how fast and how far you can expand. For example, Under Armour, I think they're killing themselves going into shoes, yeah, trying to compete with Nike. You know, the staying on the clothing side is, you know, really their bread and butter, and they've struggled because of it. You know, and Tommy John, we'll see. I mean, I think there's such a huge opportunity in underwear. You sometimes, you know, you get, as an entrepreneur, you can get bored. Oh, we've been talking about it for 5 years, but you know, many consumers don't even know about it yet. So,
yeah,
you know, you have to stay persistent in that focus and not let it, you know, not stray too much from it too fast.
Well, at the risk of getting us wound back up as we're winding down, this point, the thought I keep having as you're explaining these expansions, I understand where the thinking comes from in the boardroom.
Yeah.
But from a brand perspective, it's a no-brainer because I think, yes, we could expand, we could do all of this, you know, great growth potential, but long-term, and what do you mean, and how well do you do it? I think you really might be sacrificing that as a brand long-term.
Well, and absolutely. And I think it comes down to the real power is dominate, not just, you know, being successful, but dominating a category. You know, for Tommy John, you know, high-end underwear or functional underwear, however you want to define it, you know, they kind of crack the surface. They're not yet dominating to the point where they can, you know, do a lot of expansion. You also get an well, there's two things. It's in the boardroom, these things sound like easy growth potential, right? Although they can undermine the power of the brand in the mind. That's the danger. But also, companies, you know, they worry too much about servicing their customers. they're customer oriented instead of competitor oriented. So, right. You know, if you ask a loyal Tommy John, you know, customer that's been around forever and is buying from them, they say, you give them a survey. Oh, I would love for you to make socks. Oh, sure. Make underwear. Sure. Make suits. You know, they'll want you to do that. But is that the right thing? Is that going to help you get new customers? Mm-hmm. And that's where the domination of the category has to be first and foremost. And sometimes it's the growth. They've created a category of, you know, super premium underwear, right? So, you know, it's building that first to a point where then you can expand. The classic example of that is Saturn automobiles. You know, they were going gangbusters, but, you know, they only had a small percentage of the small car market. They didn't dominate it. They were, you know, 14%. You have to, you know, dominate that category. Instead of dominating small cars and sedans, they decided to expand into all types of cars, which eventually, you know, imploded the whole brand.
That is the, these are cautionary tales. So we need more brand people in the boardroom.
Yes, indeed.
Laura, where could folks go to learn more about what you're up to?
Well, that's easy. There's just one website address. You can get everything you need to know about myself and my dad and our books and everything else. It's Reese.com. It's R-I-E-S. And we've got links. We're on LinkedIn and Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and everything else. And so check us out.
Awesome. Well, we will link up to that in our show notes. Laura, thank you for joining us on Brand.
Thank you.
And big thanks again to our sponsor, 2020, your source for on-brand photography for your brand. Get 5 photos with 2020's 1-week free trial at 2020.com/on-brand. That's the word 20, then the number 20. .com/onbrand. On-brand is a production of Brand Driven Digital, helping complex organizations simplify their branding and marketing to unlock growth. More, including the links we discussed on this episode, at branddrivendigital.com. Remember, you can subscribe to the show via iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn. Speaking of iTunes, if you like what you're hearing, head over there, give us a quick rating and review, help others find the show. Until next week, I'm Nick Westergaard, and I'll see you on the internet.
This has been the On Brand Podcast, presented by Brand Driven Digital. For show notes, links, and more, go to onbrandpodcast.com. Remember, you can subscribe to the show and leave a rating and review at iTunes and Stitcher. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.